2 Samuel chapter 9. And David said, "Is there still anyone left of the house of Saul, that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Now there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba, and they called him to David. And the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" And he said, "I am your servant." And the king said, "Is there not still someone of the house of Saul, that I may show kindness of God to him?" Ziba said to him, "There is still a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in his feet." The king said to him, "Where is he?" And Ziba said to the king, "He is in the house of Machir, the son of Ammiel, at Lo Debar." Then King David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, son of Ammiel, at Lo Debar. And Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and paid homage. And David said, "Mephibosheth." And he answered, "Behold, I am your servant." And David said to him, "Do not fear, for I will show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan, and I will restore to you all the land of Saul your father, and you shall eat at my table always." And he paid homage and said, "What is your servant that you should show regard for a dead dog such as I?" Then the king called Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, "All that belonged to Saul and to all his house I have given to your master's grandson. And you and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him and shall bring in the produce that your master's grandson may have bread to eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, shall always eat at my table." Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, "According to all that my lord the king commands his servant, so will your servant do." So Mephibosheth ate at David's table, like one of the king's sons. And Mephibosheth had a young son, whose name was Micah. And all who lived at Ziba's house became Mephibosheth's servants. So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he ate always at the king's table. Now he was lame in both his feet. Chapters 9 and 10 of 2 Samuel are a high point. It gets a bit of a high note in 2 Samuel. And then next time when we pick up on 2 Samuel, we'll be in chapter 10, we'll be picking up on a high point. But then it starts to go downhill from that point. So David, at this point, it looks like that David is pointing us to be what the solution to the world's problems are. Well, he does. David does point us to the solution of all the world's problems. But David is not the solution and actually is part of the problem, like the rest of us. But chapters 9 and 10 is about David's kindness. He keeps his word. He makes and keeps his covenants. Now, have you ever wondered why God would bother with you? Have you ever had that experience when you've looked at the mirror at home and thought, "He can't be pleased with this"? If that's how you feel, your instincts are good. I can't stand here and tell you that you're worthy, because you're not. The gospel of St. L'Oreal, you know, the "you're worth it," is a lie. And many churches, their message is all about boosting confidence and ego and esteem. You can't call anything a sin because people might feel bad about it. But there's a problem with that approach, and that's reality. It's like arguing with gravity, because you know what's on your inside, and so does God. And because the Bible tells me, so do I know what's on the inside of you. So why do I bother speaking to you about it, if you're not worth it, and so on? It's firstly because we're told to in Scripture, because actually there is hope that's much more substantial than is offered in the "just don't upset anybody" type church. And secondly, I'm in the same boat as you. And if you knew what was in the inside of me, you'd probably be struggling to sit there and listen. The repeated word in this passage is a Hebrew word, is hesed. It's one of those words that A lot of people know the Bible meaning of certain Greek and Hebrew words, and hesed is one of them. And normally gets translated something like kindness or loving kindness, sometimes love. And it's associated with covenant commitments. And that's the reason why people like us can come before a holy God. We've got no right to come before him, but because of the covenant and the resulting kindness, loving kindness of the covenant, ordinary people like us can come before God. And that's much more substantial than saying, well, you're worth it, you're so lovely. It's a covenant commitment on God's part for you. Now, three angles we're going to look at about this covenant that's in this passage. One of them is about covenant commitments in verses 1 to 4, the provisions of the covenant in 5 to 10, and then the kind of people that the covenant embraces in verses 11 to 13. So the first thing is covenant commitments in verses 1 to 4. So a covenant is a promise with teeth. It's a bit like a contract. It's a two-way agreement. And so often what would happen in ancient times, well, we have contracts when you two parties will sign a document together, and we have a covenant in marriage, that's a covenant. But the way an ancient covenant was drawn up often in those days is you would kill an animal, you would cut it in half, and the two parties would walk between the parts of the dead animal. And it's saying, if we either break this covenant, this is what will happen to us. And in the Bible, the covenant is an organized, a central organizing theme that the sort of story of the Bible goes around, and also it's how we relate to God, our covenant with God. But also in the Bible, as would have happened all over the place at that time, is there a covenant between people when one person and another makes a covenant together? And 2 Samuel 9 is actually about one of those. It's a covenant between two men. But as we see, it points ahead to something more significant to us. So David and Jonathan made a covenant with each other. That was back in 1 Samuel in chapter 18 and repeated in chapter 20. And it was interesting when we looked at it because Jonathan was far older than David and he's the heir. He's Saul's son, the son's king, the son of the king. So he's heir to the throne. But by faith, Jonathan recognizes that David is God's king, the anointed one, the Christ. And so he makes a covenant commitment with him. And in chapter 20, the covenant commitment he asks of David is, let me live and my family. Let me and my family live. Now, typically in those days, a new king comes to the throne. He cleans house. And you can see examples of this if you go to the British Museum and you see various kingdoms rising and falling, and that you read about them, what they would do is a new king would come and he would kill anybody associated with the old king. He would take the old king's wives for himself and kill all the offspring, all the sons and daughters, maybe the servants, anyone else, nephews, nieces, kill them all so there's no threat to his throne. And you actually get this when you start reading through one or two kings, examples of this happening in the Bible story. So no rival heirs. That's what would be done. And David makes this promise to Jonathan that he will let him and his family live. Now, if you make a promise, you should keep it. But, you know, if you make a promise, I'll pick you up if you are at this point, at this time, and the person isn't there. You know, I think if the other parties are no-show, I think most people think you're fine. But notice here what David does. He goes out of his way. We keep being told David is delivered from his enemies. Saul's house is now more or less gone. But David is keen to seek out anybody, anyone that's left, to show kindness to. So Christians have these covenant commitments. We have marriage. That's the most obvious kind of covenant some of us are committed to. We become members of a church. In baptism, we make covenant commitments. So in those in baptism, in membership, we make a covenant commitment to God. We make a covenant commitment to the other members of a church. In ordination, elders, deacons, ministers make covenant commitments, and we take those seriously. And there's a vertical commitment to God in these things, but also there's a horizontal commitment. There's a commitment that people make to one another but with a vertical dimension to those even, because we make those commitments to one another in the presence of God. So David is a good example of taking covenant responsibility seriously. We should take our covenant responsibilities seriously. But David here is not just the model believer. He is that, but he's more than that. He's God's anointed king. And that's the reason why this episode is retold to us. So David, the covenant king, we've seen lots about the covenant and his kingship in the last couple of chapters. And he is how God rules on the earth. God shows us something about himself through David in his rule. And we notice in verse 3, what David says is he wants to show God's kindness. So God's kindness is going to be shown through David. So there's this horizontal commitment that David has to Jonathan. Jonathan's long dead now, but it's before the Lord. And he's going to show God's kindness to anyone left in Jonathan's family. David is the means of God's kindness. So they send for this guy called Ziba, and he's a former aide of Saul, and Ziba knows of a man. And the information here is pretty minimal and just factual. Ziba is not a main character, but this is the first of three times we're going to hear about him, and a bit of a spoiler for when we come back to 2 Samuel. He is not a goodie, and there's some clues here about that. So notice he does not bow. Just a little detail, he doesn't bow, contrast to Mephibosheth, we'll get in a minute. He describes Mephibosheth, but he doesn't name him. And this flags up where the story goes. And there's a bit of, one of the commentators I was reading said, it's one of the most gripping parts of the Bible, from this chapter through to 2 Kings chapter 2, or a bit earlier than that, it's some of the most gripping bits of the Bible. And it, really intriguing bits of character development and lots of action. You'll just have to wait until we come back to that. The bits we'll look at between now and then will be good too. But the point so far is that there are covenant commitments. There are covenant commitments for us. But the shocking thing to think about is that God and his Christ make covenant commitments. And that's where our confidence comes from, is that Jesus Christ and God the Father have covenant obligations. So if we should keep ours, they will keep theirs. You better be sure that they're going to keep them. So the second thing is what these covenant provisions are. What's the benefit of being in covenant? Verses 5 to 10. And this is the heart of the chapter, especially verse 7. Verse 7 is David's offer to Mephibosheth and to show him kindness for the sake of the covenant he had with Jonathan. And either side of verse 7, we get a response from Mephibosheth. The response to be summoned and the response to the kindness that he receives. So what is David offering and how does Mephibosheth receive it? Well, let's look at it in sequence, and that itself is instructive. So first, David calls for him. He calls him from his house in Lo Debar. Again, we can't find a place with that name. And so the commentators have found a place that's got a similar name. They say maybe he's from there. But interestingly, Debar means word or thing in Hebrew, and lo means no. So literally, he comes from no word or nothing. He comes from nothing. And this is the first time we get Mephibosheth's name. And we're not quite sure how to translate it, but it's something like one who scatters shame or one from the mouth of shame. So there's a connection with, early on we had Ishbosheth, which means man of shame. Ish just means shame. So there's a connection here with Saul and his family, and there's something about that that brings shame. So this is shame from nowhere. And then we get Mephibosheth's response in verse 6. He says, he falls on his face. He comes to David, falls on his face, pays homage, and says, "Behold, I am your servant." So he bows and claims to be David's servant, the opposite to Ziba's response. There's a note of fear here. And remember that usual policy, kill all the survivors? He's got a right to fear. He's been called into the king's presence. He was born on the wrong side. He's an enemy. He's standing now before the one who has a right to strike him down dead. But what does David do? Verse 7, first words, "Do not fear. It's a great blessing of the covenant. Do not fear. And look at verse 7. He says, verse 7, David said to him, "Do not fear, for I will show kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan, and I will restore to you all the land of Saul your father, and you shall eat at my table always." So the reason is, I'm going to show kindness to your father Jonathan because of their covenant. I'm going to show kindness to him. Hence, don't fear. And the kindness is going to be shown in concrete terms. Restore Saul's lands to Mephibosheth and to eat at the king's table. Now, remember, the covenant with Jonathan is, don't kill my family. That's all David had to do. But he seeks out Mephibosheth and he calls him. So the covenant with Jonathan is then applied to his son, Mephibosheth. And then he gives him a land and a place at the table. So from no thing, he's given something, a place and a table. And he's treated as a royal son. And we're going to meet him again in later chapters. He's still living in the royal house. So David doesn't meet covenant obligations. He goes above and beyond covenant obligations. He only had to ensure safety, but instead he brings blessing. And Mephibosheth's response at the beginning was, "I am your servant," and it ends in gratitude, surprise, and humility. In verse 8, he paid homage again and said, "What is your servant that you should show regard for a dead dog such as I?" What a wonderful thing to show to me, David, he's saying to him. He thought maybe he's being summoned to be killed and he's being summoned to be blessed. In verses 9 to 10, all those promises are put into effect. David appoints Ziba and his family to manage the land so that there's an income for Mephibosheth. And we notice that Ziba himself is rich with a large family and lots of servants. How he's going to play this position, we'll have to wait to find out. But we see again David is laying a pattern for his greater son. So David calls. He calls an enemy. He calls shame from nowhere and nothing. And he shows him covenant kindness beyond what is required. And the response is, in the king's presence, to bow down in awe. He has the right to strike you down, but you bow down in awe, in gratitude and humility. Mephibosheth doesn't say, "Yeah, of course, sure, I'm worth it." He's amazed at the king's generosity to him and that he's treated as a prince. Now, why does David act like that? Well, it's because of covenant loyalty to Jonathan before God. God the Father and Son have a covenant loyalty that is to a far higher standard, and you can be confident that they will keep it to each other. And you're the beneficiary of that. And you may feel like Mephibosheth. I'm a dog. I'm not worth it. But this is where the I'm worth it gospel fails. Our confidence is not being worth it. Our confidence is a covenant sworn on oath, paid for in the blood of Christ. So the covenant provision is for us the blood of Christ and the promise of a place and to eat at the table and to receive mercy and kindness. Because of a covenant. Now the third thing is, and we've touched on it already, but the third thing is the kind of people that the covenant embraces in verses 11 to 13. So we've seen now all David's commitments are in place and property is given to Mephibosheth and he eats at the table as if he was a prince and Ziba and his family serve him. Now, we're going to see more reactions when we come back to this next year at some point. Ziba is all about what he can get, even if it's at other people's expense, at their reputation or worse. He will throw others under the bus so he can get something. In chapter 10, there are these kings who are offered also covenant faithfulness and kindness from David, but they reject it, what's offered, although some then turn back to David. And then Mephibosheth here, who accepts, who's surprised and humbled. And so chapters 9 and 10 are a contrast with each other. Those with power are humbled. They're either humbled and turn, or they're humbled and become more defiant. and Mephibosheth, who bows down in homage before the king. But for us to think about now is, what man is Mephibosheth? Now, we've seen some of this already in chapter 9, but they're repeated lots of times in verses 11 to 13. He's the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul. Now we're told that he has a son, Micah, in verse 12, and that he is lame. And that's, we already knew that, but it's repeated and it's the last thing we're told in this chapter. And also, we've heard earlier, haven't we, he's from Lo Debar. He's from nothing. And he's blessed by the king and he sits at the table. Now, first take the family issue. He's the grandson of Saul. And now we find also he has a son. So although we never hear of him, we've not heard of this guy before, or again, it's just something to be noted, that David seems to be illogical here, even reckless. Here is a potential contender and his son, a contender to the throne, much of the rest of David's life is taken up with, people challenging his position to the throne. So not only Mephibosheth, but Micah as well. And potentially this arrangement could continue, because if Micah remains within covenant bounds, and he has children, David is committed to all of them. Because covenant goes from generation to generation. David makes a covenant with Jonathan. And the blessing of that, Jonathan's now dead, but the blessing of that covenant now flows to Mephibosheth and on to Micah. Unless they step out of that covenant arrangement. And this covenant arrangement encourages them to stay in step with David the Christ. And this is the sort of thing that we've talked about, covenant commitments before and covenant community, and we've talked about baptism and why we pass that on to our children, that we encourage them to stay in the covenant family, in within these covenant bounds. So Mephibosheth is the grandson, or they would use the word son, of a fallen king who's the enemy. And we've seen these parallels with Genesis before. We are sons of a fallen king, Adam. Adam has this king status. He fell. We are enemies. We are born enemies of God and his king, the Christ. In this passage, it keeps on repeating that he's lame, that he's crippled. Mephibosheth was mentioned earlier in passing. Just got one verse on him. And I just said we'll come back to him. That was in 2 Samuel 4:4. And the verse was just dropped in the chapter about Ishbosheth's murder. And the point is that Saul's family is being wiped out to clear the path for David. And the verse tells us how Mephibosheth was crippled. His nurse or his nanny fled with him when he's very young, and she fell. And the injuries, as she fell onto him, were permanent. So presumably she fled in fear because the child in her care could be a victim of one of these clean sweeps where they just wipe out all the family. And even if David didn't want that personally, we've noticed through 1 and 2 Samuel how some people help David in ways that he doesn't really find very helpful. And so this boy's disability is related to the fact that his family is at war with David, the Christ. It's a constant reminder. Now, a crippled king is a possibility, but unlikely, because everyone would view him as weak. But interesting, there's a parallel here in the law where the Levites who serve at the tabernacle and then at the temple, the crippled ones can't serve, but they are fed by the altar food that the others serve at. So they're fed in the same way, but they can't serve. And here's a parallel. There's one who's denied kingship and is crippled, but is fed at the king's table. And it's striking too, because do you remember David, a very un-PC remark about cripples in chapter 5. So the Jebusites, when he attacks Jerusalem, the Jebusites taunt David and say, even the blind and cripples could defend Jerusalem against you. And they lose. And David remarks, well, I don't really think very highly of the blind and cripples. They can't come into my house. So he's taunting them back that, well, you must be blind and crippled then. And returns the taunt. So we see that David excludes the Jebusites, calling them cripples, but he shows hospitality to this cripple who's in the covenant. So to sum up Mephibosheth, his name is about shame. He probably experiences shame because of his family roots. He's from nothing, from no word. He is the enemy of the king. He's the son of a fallen king. His son is a potential rival and he's a cripple. And David gives him an inheritance and a place at the table and treats him as a son, as one of his. And the reason for this is only kindness from a covenant commitment. And we're told that the source of this kindness is God himself. Now, by now, you probably have worked out the connections with David's greater son, Jesus, and how Jesus shows his covenant kindness to us. But it's striking, isn't it? Those here who are shamed by their sin, you think about things that you've thought and done, and you are ashamed. There's times that we still feel that shame and burden, that we're from nowhere, that we're not gods by our greatness, that we're an enemy. The New Testament, in, for example, Colossians 1, that we're enemies in our minds and as well as our actions, that we're sons and daughters of Adam, the fallen king, and our children are born in sin as enemies as well. And in his ministry, how Jesus especially is merciful to the disabled. This is us, isn't it? This is talking of Mephibosheth is a picture of us as much as David is a picture of Jesus. If you feel that you're not good enough to come into the presence of God, you're right. But we've made covenant obligations. God has made covenant obligations. Not only with you, but the Father and the Son have made a covenant agreement with each other. And that's a great assurance, isn't it? That it's not bound in with us. And the parallels with Jesus continue as he offers blessing and a land and to eat at his table. It's striking how often Jesus uses that imagery of eating with Jesus. One of them, Luke 12, is particularly shocking that not only do we eat with Jesus, but he comes and serves the servants at the table. And this is why the gospel is the gospel and is really good news. Rather than the gospel of, you're worth it, you're really nice, you've done nothing wrong, don't worry, the feel-good, build-up-your-self-esteem gospel, just being told you're worth it is and that no one's ever done anything bad eventually clashes with reality and your world crashes down as you realise you aren't worth it. It's also massively judgmental. You're worth it, I'm worth it, but those girls over there, they're not worth it, normally about some debatable political issue. But the gospel, the really good news, is that you're not worth it. And yet, while we were still sinners, at that point, in your sin, you at your worst, Christ died for you. At that point. Will he change his mind? No, because God, the eternal Trinity, has bound himself to action by a covenant, and he does not change. And so he takes nobody's from nowhere Essex, weighed down by guilt and shame, the cripples and the unable, those who've got nothing great to offer, those who have rebelled with their equally rebellious kids, and he promises them a land, and he bids them, come eat with me. That's your confidence. And in chapter 10, there's a warning how not to respond, not to shun the mercy shown to you. But chapter 9 is how to receive fear, awe, humility. And that we should feel that. The same response that Mephibosheth had. Me? You've done this for a dead dog like me? What have I got to offer that you've done this for me? It's not that, yeah, well, of course you would have done it for me. No, you've done this for me? And then gratitude. And then, of course, come and eat. It's striking, isn't it, that we're not more excited about the gospel, that we don't have the sense of privilege and wonder of what God has done for us, that we should never get tired of hearing it. I'm disturbed if ever I hear a Christian, I don't think I've heard it from any of you, but I have heard it from Christians, oh, I know this, I've done that, now can I move on to 1.2 or whatever it is? We should never lose amazement that even you are invited to the king's table. And that's what worship is responding in humility to the good news. And the confidence, you should have confidence as we come before God, because not because of how you feel about you or even about God. It's not about how lovely you are or how loving you are. but Christ's covenant commitment to you that goes over and above any of the demands. And then that becomes the source for us to show God's love to others. Not we've got to kind of muster it up and well it up from within, but like David, that we can be the means that God uses. But we've got to get it the right way around. It's that God shows us covenant mercies, and then through us we can be a means for his love to others. And in part, we do that by keeping the covenant commitments that we've made in our marriages, to our churches, and so on and so forth. Keep the covenant with the Lord, and keep the covenant commitments with each other, because he will keep his covenant commitment to you. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for your loving kindness, that you've gone over and above what has been demanded. We deserve actually nothing from you, and yet you've made a covenant with us and with our children to show us kindness, that those of us who are, we are from nowhere, we have nothing to offer you, we feel shame, and yet you offer us a promised land and bid us to come and eat and treat us as princes and princesses at your table. And for this we give you thanks and ask that we'd be drawn to your covenant and not to look at our feelings. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.